Welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for February 11th. It's brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and with me is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Well, I'm with you, and that's good enough for me, man.
You know what I was thinking? Is we should both change our last names to Harbaugh.
Okay.
And then you could be Jim Harbaugh, and I'd be John Harbaugh, and we could join the family. Who'd have it better than us?
Nobody, baby.
Well, I'm glad you came over for the Super Bowl. I'm sorry your team lost, but it was a good game and it was fun to have you over.
No, I'm kind of calming down. I was actually more hurt by it than I thought I would be, you know. But nothing got kicked, nothing got no angry words, no outbursts or anything. So yeah.
I mean, you took it like a pro, and I was shocked. I wanted to see not the kicking, of course, and throwing in my apartment, but I wanted to see some more emotion. But hey, I think I showed more emotion during the game than you did.
Well, I look at it this way. They gave me a lot of entertainment, more than the season ending after however many games they play in the regular season. So good. Thank them for that.
Well, one more step for the 49ers, and they'll if they improve on this past season, then they'll be Super Bowl winners next year. We got a great show for you this time. It features an interview with Aaron Guile, the former Yakult Swallows outfielder. We're going to talk about the WBC and touch on some camp topics while answering some great listener questions. The bases are full, so let's get started.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so Aaron Guile, I caught up with him. Actually, full disclosure on this interview now. I called him one day, and we did this really good interview, and I was trying something new, and it didn't work because there was this loud buzz throughout the interview. And, I tried to clean it up as best I could, and it just, I couldn't get it to where it was good enough for you listeners. So I called him back, and I said, can we do the interview again? And we did it twice. So actually, in the beginning of the interview, I say, yeah, it's been a long time since I talked to you, and I start laughing because it had been a couple days. We talked last week. Now, he's taken a job with the Kansas City Royals as a coach. Mm-hmm. And, I had fond memories of Aaron Guile. I thought he was, and don't get me wrong, he really was productive, but injuries really took their toll on him in his last two seasons, I think.
Well, I think with Aaron, it was always a case of, here's a guy who was remarkably upbeat and level. You know, he was calm, and he didn't throw things or have tantrums, and despite his really up and down time in Japan, he was playing, he wasn't playing, he was hurt, he was healthy, and he wasn't playing. He was doing great, or he was having a tough patch. He was always positive and well spoken. So it was hard to imagine him, that he actually had bad patches in it or bad looking patches. I would say in his career.
Yeah, 441 games over five seasons. He hit 90 home runs and drove in 239 runs. I mean, he was really productive. And then I looked at his average, and it was 234, and that was kind of shocking because I just assumed that he'd at least be up in the 270s, 280s range to me.
Well, he had two seasons where he was when he played pretty much the full seasons. In those years, he was spectacular. And then the other seasons, his second season was a tough one because he didn't have the on-base percentage, which was part of his trademark. Basically, he was a guy who got on base like crazy. He got hit a lot, and he got on base like crazy. And he had a really good arm and, positioned himself well in the outfield. He wasn't the fastest guy, but a real smart player, a lot of fun to talk to. And, you don't think of him having bad years, but I mean, in contrast to his good times, he struggled a bit for a variety of reasons, which he would be the one to explain it, not me.
Right. Now, I didn't even realize that he played with Team Canada in the WBC in 2009.
Okay.
I had forgotten about that completely. But he said, now he talked about this job that he's doing with the Royals, and he said basically he spent last year just watching, just observing, and he had to learn all the philosophies and methods and everything that's going on with the team. So it was really interesting. It's too bad we didn't talk about that stuff too, but we only had a limited amount of time since it was interview number two.
Terrell better than interview number three. So.
All right. Well, there's a lot of things that we could discuss for days about this interview, but let's take a listen to it first. Okay, we're joined this week by Aaron Guile, someone I haven't talked to in a while. Ha ha ha. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's see. Now, your expectations when you were starting your career in Japan were what exactly?
Well, a lot of players, when they think about Japan and they go to play in Japan, the information about what the league is like is kind of limited. So people just see it as a foreign league, and they think that it's not as good as the major leagues. And so they feel like they're kind of giving up on something in the States to go play there. So I consulted with a number of players that I had known who have gone over there, one guy being George Arias, who played with Hanshin Tigers, and also a player that ended up being my teammate, Adam Riggs, with the Swallows. So by talking to those guys about what to expect, they gave me a lot of information about the culture and the style of baseball. And probably two or three years prior to me actually coming to Japan, I had people talk to me about potential of going over there. So I started to do a little bit of research to find out that, you know, the quality of baseball is very, very good. You know, the culture is obviously very, I want to say it's fairly similar to, as far as lifestyle for a foreigner as it would be to be in the States, and just a real welcoming country. So my expectations were of a very good quality league and a really welcoming society and real rich culture to come and be a part of.
And how do you think you did in your career here?
Well, you know what, when you look back on it, I'm proud of a lot of things that I did. You know, I also have some regrets. I played 5 years there, which is, not typical. So I'm proud of that. But at the same time, I was, had some injuries that I felt got in the way of me maybe having some better years statistics-wise. But, I'm proud of what I accomplished my first year. I did really well and was one off the home run title. And, I had some injuries in there and then came back to have a strong year. But if I'm going to look back and I'm going to look back on my career over in Japan as a whole, about not only my performance, but, kind of what I took from being over there, and then hopefully, what I contributed as well as a teammate and as a person.
Right.
With there only being a limited amount of foreigners over there, I know a lot of the guys that I played with, they want guys that contribute, but they also want guys that are respectful of the team and the country and the culture. And, sometimes you get foreign players over there that are really humble and appreciate the opportunity, which is how I felt. But sometimes you get guys that come over there that they bring in arrogance that maybe they brought from the major leagues, and that usually rubs a lot of the guys over the wrong way. So I think I'm pretty proud of the fact that I was a fairly humble person over there and really mixed in well with my teammates. And I'm hoping that if you do speak with them, then they speak highly of me, and I think we developed a really good friendship.
Yeah, I could see that when I would go out to the park and cover games and stuff before the games, the camaraderie that you guys had, even with the Japanese, your Japanese teammates. So, yeah, so now the New York Yankees obviously are known as the evil empire, and the Giants here in Japan are somewhat similar. What do you think the Swallows are as an organization, and could you just run down some of the CL teams as you see them?
I think with certain teams over in Japan, you can draw parallels to teams in the States. We've discussed that many times when we've been over there, and since I think a lot of people compare the Tokyo Giants to the New York Yankees, and I think they draw that parallel because of probably the market and the amount of money that the team has at its disposal, and also the fact that when other of the top line guys are available, they definitely try to go after those guys. So I would say that you could probably say that they're very similar. I think we've talked about maybe the Tianjin Tigers being similar to the Boston Red Sox. Where, you can also draw a parallel to the fans as well. But the Yankee fans, they're tough, they're fair, but they're a certain way. Whereas the Giants fans, I think people just become a Giant fan by birth. Whereas the Tiger fans are similar to Boston, where they tend to be very, very passionate, and they love their team, they follow their team, and especially when you play in Koshin, there's a lot of electricity there, and when the team does lose, the fans really feel it, whereas I think with the Giants, sometimes they just go home and wait for another day. So there's, when you also teams like the Swallows or the Carp or the Bay Stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really have to look. I would say that the Swallows might be a team. I think you could probably put them in a team, maybe like a Seattle, you know, team that, you know, maybe a team like Seattle might have a little bit more money, but than the Swallows might have in comparison. But
right.
A team that is strong at times, and then they go through years where they aren't as strong. And the Swallows seem to be that way. You know, when they seem to draft really strong players, you know, 3 or 4 years later, the team seems to be strong. When they don't, you can definitely see how the quality of that team goes down. You know, they don't necessarily chase, you know, any big name guys. And I think what they do is they rely on bringing power foreign hitters in there to balance the lineup and really propel that team into trying to go for the, you know, first, second, or third place. And
right.
I think, you know, my career, you've seen, you know, power guys. You've seen Valentin recently, Milic, who I think has done a great job, and you know, guys like myself and Ramirez and Rick. You know, those are the types of players that they try to come in to offset maybe some of the weaknesses that they have. And, you know, you work yourself all the way down to teams like the Carp, and I think they're more of a team that I would say maybe like the Pittsburgh Pirates, where they don't seem to have a, you know, a defined strategy or a defined type of player. They seem to change year to year, and that just kind of shows with maybe some of the success and failures that they've had.
Right. Now, do you think the Swallows, I mean, can they win with their current vision?
I think Swallows, I think it's going to be very difficult for teams like the Bay Stars or the Carp to be successful because they don't seem to have a uniform kind of strategy from year to year. But I think the Swallows, and especially from what I've seen, they really do want to win. I think what hampers them is you know, they seem to constantly be in the shadow of the Giants, Tigers, and the Dragons. But, you know, I've seen them really, really improve with their pitching. With pitchers like Tatsuyama, you know, and some of the younger players like Aoki coming, who is obviously now gone, but players like that coming through. But I think in the market in Tokyo, they have the ability to bring fans and make some money and sign guys. But from what I've seen, they seem to have a better vision than some of the lower level teams as far as how the direction that the team is going. And also the coaching staff that they bring on. There's a great atmosphere around the team. Ogawa-san was, you know, especially when he came through, he really preached team and a looser atmosphere and a more comfortable environment for the guys. And I think as long as you have staff like that and an atmosphere that they have with the Swallows, I think they're always going to be competitive. Depending on, you know, whether they're able to, you know, get a lot of their good players on the same page at the same time, I think that's going to be what's going to get them to you know, really head for maybe second or third or first place.
Okay. Now, Jim said before that you might be interested in coaching, perhaps even in Japan. What did you learn from the coaches here that is of practical value for you?
Well, this past summer, I did take a job with the Royals down in their Arizona League team, and you know, it was my first coaching experience. You know, the last probably 2 years. Being in Japan, I became a lot more vocal with the players, and so I got a little taste of what it would be like to, you know, to be a coach. But what I did learn from coaching in the States this year was that you have to have an organizational philosophy, and you have to check in with people about the type of information that you give to the players and who you work with. And there's a lot of boundaries that you have to be aware of, and
right.
You really can't develop a personality as far as coaching. So it actually is quite difficult. In Japan, I could sit down with any number of coaches. It could be with my hitting coach. It could be with the infield coach, the outfield coach. You know, there'd be times I'd even speak with the pitching coach just to see how his Japanese philosophy would be to try to get me out as a foreign hitter.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like in Japan, that free flow of information was a lot easier. And I felt like coaches didn't have to worry about checking in with somebody before giving that information. I felt like we could go around and around and just throw things out there and communicate a lot better. I found it to be a much better learning environment. You know, even as an aging outfielder and knowing that my career was coming to an end, I was never told that you know, I wasn't allowed to speak with certain players or I wasn't allowed to share something with certain players. A lot of my managers and coaches were really open-minded about allowing me to talk, and I think it was beneficial for me to sit there and absorb information I got from a lot of my Japanese coaches. players in the States that I had not heard before. So I think it made me a better player, but also made me, you know, better potential coach to hear two sides of it.
Right, right. Okay, now I want to turn to the WBC. Now, I think Canada has a really good team for the upcoming tournament, some really good players, and we know Team Canada beat Team USA in the tournament before. So what are Canada's chances, do you think, in this year's event?
Well, I think, as long as all the Canadian players are healthy and the ones that have committed participate, I think Canada's got a very good shot. They always have a strong offense. It's always left-handed dominant, and I think there's only been a couple players that have said that they're not participating. So, unfortunately, Ryan Dempster being one of them, obviously a strong right-handed pitcher, and that really hurt Team Canada because of their lack of depth in pitching. So, when you line them up against the Japanese teams or the Dominican team or the American team, and you see the depth of the pitching in some of the other teams, then you compare it with Canada. I think it puts Canada at a pretty big disadvantage. You know, we've always had a weakness in pitching. Mm. When guys don't commit to it, it makes it even worse. So I think I think the team's going to hit really well, but it's going to be about whether our starting pitchers can be strong, and that's going to tell you whether our team is there. Well, whether the Canadian team is going to be able to compete in it. So it's they're obviously in a very tough bracket with the United States and Mexico.
What team do you think is going to win?
Well, I've heard, and it's always biased from the American media, but they're favoring the United States to win. And when you're leaving names like Verlander and Sabathia off the roster, I think it changes things quite a bit.
And Trout.
And Trout and some of these other great players. I think it's a shame that those guys don't participate because it's a great tournament. I played it in 2006, and that was a great experience. I mean, I don't think guys realize what a fun tournament and what a fun experience it can be. But I think with the United States leaving off some key names, I think that might come back to bite them. And I think they're anticipating, other teams do the same. I think it's possible the United States can be favored because they have such great depth. But I think they're going to find with starters like R.A. Dickey and some of the other guys that they have put and they're relying on to be their 1, 2, and 3. I think it's going to be a challenge for them. There's teams I know that I'm kind of partial to Japan, and the U.S. media is coming down hard in Japan because of their lack of Major League Baseball participants. But the truth is that the Japanese league has such great depth and has such great pitching that in a tournament short like that, the pitching is going to be what dictates wins and losses. So I think Japan's going to be quite strong.
All right, so you're picking Japan.
I have no problem picking Japan again. They surprised a lot of people the first year, and it seems like over in the States they somehow surprised people the second time. But, it's going to be very difficult for them to sneak up on anybody. But I think that as prepared as the Japanese players are, I think a lot of players in the States don't actually get started until into January, whereas the Japanese guys and most of my teammates and guys that I know, I mean, they're training right from November, December.
Right.
And when they dip into the WBC, they're ready to go.
Yeah.
Same with the Koreans. And I don't know much about the Korean team this year, but I know they have a very aggressive offensive style. And they seem to have strong pitching, too, so I wouldn't count them out.
All right. Well, we won't be counting anybody out. We're gonna see how it plays out, and we'll see if Japan can do well. But thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. So thank you very much again, Aaron. We appreciate your time, or your double time.
Okay. Is this called double talk?
We could do that times two. what stood out for you in the interview?
Well, yeah, it's hard to say what stood out. I would say a lot of things stood out because he has a knack for saying things which you just don't normally think about, and he says them in a very clear way that you understand what he's talking about. So I love it. I love the talking about the Japanese coaches, because one of my favorite bits is Warren Cromartie's book, Slugging It Out in Japan, where he talked about one of the themes was the Giants coach who'd come up to him as he was shagging flies in the outfield, and he'd say, he'd give him basically a weather report. You know, the wind's blowing in today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like he didn't notice that the wind was blowing, you know, and he'd say, well, be careful about it, and the wind's blowing out, and be careful about it, and today we're playing on artificial turf, and be careful. You know, it was the coach's job to feed him useless information as part of his job. And so it's really interesting to hear, you know, I've heard players tell me about the coaches who are really important for them and the managers who are really important for their development as players.
Mm-hmm.
But, Aaron says it in a kind of a different way that gives you insight not only to what's done in Japan, but also what's done in the majors.
The things that he talked about, were in terms of the coaching staff, it caught me by surprise, because I thought that it would be easier to go up in the States and have that easy free flowing information going, that it would be more difficult in Japan. And essentially what he's saying is until you have all the philosophies of the organization, using Moneyball as an example, let's say, let's take more walks, and this is how you're going to take the walks. These are the pitches you're going to take walks on. Instead of doing that you could just go up to a player and start giving them information in Japan, and that was easier to do that than it was in the United States. That was a shocker for me.
Well, certainly that has changed. You know, that the whole Moneyball thing, that teams can have radically different ways. You know, that the ways teams approach the game now change radically and unpredictably. You know, they might have found something, you know, the front office guys, the MBAs might have found something, that they want you to, you know, they want to start implementing, and you never heard of it. This is not something that, you know, used to have different ways of managing. You know, you had Casey Stengel wanted, you know, people to do a certain way. You know, he focused on the double plays, and when you're in our organization, you know, you'll learn how to turn a double play if you're an infielder, but, and emphasize certain things, but not to the point of, you know, we have to do this. Of course, and if you're the Oakland A's, you have to do that to compete, because you don't have the money to spend on people who can do inefficient things.
Now, the other thing that caught my ear or stood out for me was him talking about essentially when foreign players are coming over here, they're essentially giving up on their big dream of playing in the major leagues, and they're just coming over here thinking that they're going to find easy success. And that stuck with me because, as you might recall, last year I talked to Coco Crisp of the Oakland A's when the A's were going to start the games up here in March. And he was saying that, you know, Japan is becoming more of a destination. It's more of a, maybe a first choice for some people, because they're stuck in the minor leagues. They realize they're not going to be major league stars, and they want to come over here and play, and I guess take advantage of the fact that this is a major league of its own, so
yep.
to speak. And it was great to hear that he did all that research, that Aaron did all that research before he came here, talking to former players, and he really got ready. It seemed like he got ready, you know, mentally before he even got here, which I think is a big step for guys.
Sure. Well, Aaron's one of those guys, and there's a number of them I come into contact who are very thorough about their approach to the game, and I think that's probably maybe the best explanation of Aaron's, you know, of that little extra that he brings to the game, is he's as thorough as anybody. I mean, he doesn't prepare. I didn't see the, you know, the pregame, I hate to use the word masochistic with Matt Martin, but he's got a pregame routine that the Japanese players really would have trouble keeping up with. But in terms of preparation and knowing what he wants to do and knowing what he needs to do, I don't think anybody is, there's going to be somebody out there who's always, you know, a little better or a little, you know, doing a little more. But I don't think there's many people who are that much better than what Aaron was trying to do.
Well, it'd be good to see him come over and coach here if he ever does get the opportunity. And I think he'd be welcome back. Some of the other things that he talked about made me think that Japan has to create that third tier, you know, that next farm team, and expand also the import restrictions so that there can be more foreign players throughout the organization. because I think it would create that competition and breed more exchange of ideas and concepts that helps the game grow. You know, all those things that he basically was talking about. In addition to, you know, helping, I guess, further the information or the exchange between the two countries, so that obviously we don't bunt enough in the States, and they bunt too much, it seems, here in Japan, and get a different brand of baseball, maybe create a different brand of baseball, perhaps.
I think a lot of people, before we had that wave of foreign managers here in the 90s, I think a lot of Americans thought that, you know, you bring a foreign manager over here, and they're going to win five, especially like a major league manager, he's going to win 5 or 10 more games than the other guys because he's going to know when not to bunt. But obviously, it's a lot more to it than that. Because, you know, there are advantages to being a foreign manager, and that's not really the big one. When you're going to bunt, when you're not going to bunt, is really a pretty small thing, actually. I think in the big picture, is whether you develop, you know, whether you get the most of the talent you have so that your talent base grows,
mm-hmm.
or whether, you know, you can't, your team collapses and falls flat. So I think, you know, that in-game strategy is really over, I think it's overplayed, because it's one thing that people can talk about. I think, you know, just putting the guys on the field who need to be on the field, making sure, you know, players are rested, they're in the right place at the right time, essentially, is a bigger deal than knowing whether, you know, when to bunt. And the other thing is, and I think Aaron touches on this too, which is kind of interesting, is his way of looking at teams, I thought, was quite interesting. Particularly with the talking about the Swallows having a plan. The Swallows did have a plan, and at the end of Aaron's career, he was kind of a victim of that plan.
Mm.
When Takata came in and basically said, "Nope, I'm here to play the young players. All you old guys go to Urawa and just sit there and wait till we call you, and it'll probably be never." So Dickie Gonzalez is out there, Kita's out there, Guile's out there. Basically, everybody over 30 was exiled to Urawa. And it was kind of silly because it was sort of a baseball by, it was kind of a paint-by-numbers baseball. In the sense, it was good that there's a plan, and I'm always a believer that having a plan is better than having no plan.
Right.
Otherwise, you can end up as Hiroshima Karp, for example, which I think is, he was spot on about Hiroshima, that you just never know what to expect from them because they don't seem to have a consistent plan. The Swallows are very good with having consistent plans. Okay, sometimes they go overboard, as they did with Takata, but right now they're really in sync. And they need that. You can't be, you know, you can't compete with the Giants unless you have a plan. So, yeah, I think Aaron would be, I think we talked about him. He talked about wanting to be a coach. I know Ramirez has talked about being a coach and being a manager. And I know, and he said, you know, if Rami-chan's a manager, I'll want to come over here and coach. And, you know, we turn things around. And the things that Alex has talked about as being a manager is to adapt elements.
Uh-huh.
That will succeed here, that will take the best of both worlds. And, you know, this was always Bobby Valentine's hopes, Trey Hillman, to a large degree. Trey Hillman, when he first came over here, was going to be, you know, he was basically an on-base percentage slugging guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Two parts. It's not about bunting. It's about getting on base and hitting the ball. And it seemed like it was such a powerful idea. And it just, for the first 2 years, the Fighters went pretty much nowhere. But, long story short, they had a tremendous plan, and they eventually had a team where that worked, and they got a different team, which was they got a pitching and defense team instead of, because when he came, it was a hitting team. And yeah. When he left, it was a pitching and defense team. So, you know, this has been one way to skin a cat. Okay.
Yeah, so I like the parallels that he drew between a lot of the team. Well, he said a few. He mentioned a few teams, and mostly Central League teams, because I asked him to do Central League teams. So, what do you think about the Pacific League teams? I have a list. I drew some parallels, and I want to see what you think.
Oh, yeah.
The Buffaloes, I liken to the Kansas City Royals.
Oh, I was wondering who was going to be the Royals.
I think there's a couple of Royals organizations out here, but yeah, I think Kansas City, because they haven't won in so long. you don't know what's going on. You can't see the plan. Although I know the Royals are supposed to be really good in the minor leagues, and it's too bad that Trey Hillman's not there now. The Lions I liken to the Baltimore Orioles and the Toronto Blue Jays because they have the history. They've won, just not recently.
Okay.
Not too recently. The Eagles I compared to the Devil Rays. The Devil Rays, not the Tampa Bay Rays. The Devil Rays in the early years.
Okay. Pre-Moneyball Rays, yeah.
Yeah. The Hawks I have the Boston Red Sox. Because they're willing to spend the money. They do win. It just hasn't been that regular. And they, I mean, if you think about it, it has been more regular than the Boston Red Sox, but they spend just as much money, I think, if not more. The Marines, Minnesota Twins. They have their championship, but, you know, it seems like they don't bring in a lot of high priced players and, they seem to be pretty frugal. And the Fighters, I liken to the California Angels or Anaheim Angels or Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Hey, Angels of Anaheim on radio?
I don't know what they are. Well, they're certainly not in Los Angeles.
They're not.
But they took Anaheim out of the name. Okay. What was wrong with California? I don't know.
Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, if you want. But that's a long story. Anyway, I would say the Fighters are more like the A's.
Mm-hmm.
But you could call, you know, just being trying, you know, just trying to be smarter than everybody else. I like the, I think the Hawks remind me, the Hawks remind me of the Cincinnati Reds, but, a lot of things going on with the Hawks. They're a complicated organization. They've certainly, they had the enormous, they're sort of like the Marlins right now. They're about half the team they were 2 years ago.
Literally.
So, yeah, it was an interesting comparison, but it really the real comparison is who has a plan and who doesn't have a clue. And the Bay Stars certainly they had a plan with Obana. I was quite surprised looking at Obana's teams, what I found. But they had a plan. It didn't work. And they've got a new organizational plan. I think there is a plan there. I think the hiring of Shun Kukazu, former Marines assistant general manager, was a massive step for them. I think a lot of these teams are getting smarter and smarter. I think Pacific League teams are smarter and smarter. The Buffaloes are a team which has been a real talent producing organization, but they're just so dumb in terms of the way they implement the talent. And you know, bringing in Okada as a manager was just a complete waste of time. So they have wasted a lot of time with their managers. So,
yeah, they look pretty lost. We'll get to them later in the camp, talk about the camp. But, yeah, it was interesting. I would like to see Aaron come over and coach here and manage, but probably coach first, I think. I think if he works his way to the managerial position, I think it'd be interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, you'll have to get in line right now. The funny thing about managing in Japan is it's sort of like a, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. It's like a kid's toy train, you know, just like all the candidates are just following each other around the track. So, you know, the Swallows got good production out of, you know, they got a tremendous turnaround out of Ogawa when Takata walked away. And basically Ogawa took the job so that they could bring in a new manager at the end of the year and fire him. And there was people in the Swallows said, let's get rid of this guy who was so successful, because the guy we really want is a big, you know, former hero. You know, he was the Yuki Saito of his generation.
Right. But you're getting rid of a guy who won a bunch of games and was way over 500 as a manager.
Yeah, he's been tremendous. But anyway, you know, if you think like who's going to be the next Swallows manager if Ogawa doesn't manage there another 5 years, which is hard to manage a long time anywhere. If his run ends, there'll be so many people saying, well, Rocky's waited 6 years. It's time for him to be the manager, whether he's qualified or not. I don't know if he wouldn't be a good manager, but I would certainly love to see Aaron come back here as a coach in any capacity. He would be good. It wouldn't have to be with the Swallows. I know there are a number of guys who are really eager to come back. And there's a bunch of guys playing here now, and you look at him and you say, this guy could really help Japan as a coach.
Yeah. Yep, that's true. All right, thank you very much again, AG. It was good talking to you twice, and hope to hear from you soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you once, man.
All right, let's move on to discuss the WBC. Now, there are some rule changes that occurred that were announced recently. I think I looked on the homepage, too, but I did see the announcement. Now, the biggest one, I think, is the pitch count. The WBC shaved 5 pitches off the limits in various rounds, 60 and 80 in the first and second rounds, respectively, and then 95 in the semifinals and final. That's about one batter, I guess, if on a good day, somewhere around there.
Going back to 2006, basically.
Uh-huh. And I didn't do enough homework to find out why they made the change, but what do you think of the impact is going to be?
I think the impact is minimal. I don't think it's going to change anything. Basically, all the managers are prepared to use basically a 2-starter setup in each game. One mm-hmm. guy 3 to 4 innings, another guy to go 3 to 4 innings, and you know, then the arsenal of relievers.
Right. I heard I heard someone in the U.S. say, "Hey, look, they don't even need to bring any starters over there. Just make it all long reliever type guys, and 2 or 3 innings for each guy, situational for the guys taking over, and certainly in the middle of innings, and then just go from there." With the pitch counts, I think, yeah, that kind of breeds that kind of thinking, I think.
You can't, the thing is, you can't use guys 3 days in a row. Of course, that's not a big problem because, especially if you're Japan, you don't play 3 days in a row. Because it's set up, they've got a long pool. Their pool starts first and ends last in Asia, and their games are scattered.
Yeah.
So they've got a big gap. So everybody will be ready for their final game against Cuba. So, yeah, that was a small one. The one that really was a rule that caught your attention. Besides that,
The mobile phone one.
Oh.
Did you see about the mobile phones will be permitted in use between the bullpens and dugouts, and that's in accordance with Major League Baseball, which has an agreement with T-Mobile, and so I guess this upcoming season they're going to be using actual mobile phones, which means they might actually be ordering pizzas now.
Okay. And as opposed to the apocryphal pizzas, you know, we've read about in and the food being ordered to the bullpen by, you know, in bowl 4 and like that.
And then the other one was the smokeless tobacco that's been banned. Did you see that one?
I missed it.
Yep. Smokeless tobacco has been banned during games.
Yeah.
That was it. What was the other one that I might have missed then?
Tiebreaker.
The tiebreaker rule, yes, I did read about that. Now, I've actually seen this in action when I was back home in the States in, 2003. And they used it in softball. And okay. What they did in softball was it was only one batter. The rule now is in the 13th inning, the batter who makes the last out in the previous inning goes to second base. And the batter who was batted before the person made the last out goes to first base. And that's how they start the 13th inning with runners on first and second.
Correct. Yeah, basically the previous two batters from the previous inning start up bases and they start the next guy up in the order. And that was first brought into baseball, I think, in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Yeah, could be fun.
Yeah, I've actually seen it in action with, like I said, with just one runner on. And it does change the scope of the game. But the game that I happened to see the first time I saw this, and like I said, it was a softball rule that I saw. You know, the run scored, and that was it in the inning, and then the home team came up, and they also pushed the home the run, so the game kept going.
The question, in Japan, what do you do? And the answer is probably bunt.
The answer is definitely bunt.
We can score one run really easily.
So can the other team, folks.
It's part of the single. Right. So anyway, so this is going to be kind of interesting. All right. So those are the WBC rules. The first round of the WBC is a round robin,
mm-hmm.
and in which they'll have tiebreakers, which brings us back to the, you know, reminds us of that messy, nasty tiebreaker caused by Bob Davidson in 2006, in which Korea went 3-0. And Japan, the United States, and Mexico were all, what was it, 2-1 or 1-1 and whatever it was, they were all tied. And they had to do it on a tiebreaker. Or actually, that was the possibility. Mexico ended up beating the United States and lost to Japan on a tiebreaker.
Right.
So, Rob Davidson tried to give it to the United States, you know, by calling that ball that hit the foul pole and bounced onto the field at a 40 down at a 45 degree. Tried to call that a double, but Mexico still won.
All right. Well, Pool A has Japan, China, Cuba, and Brazil. Pool B, Korea, the Netherlands, Australia, and Taiwan, Chinese Taipei, whatever you want to call it. Pool C, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and Spain, and Pool D, the USA, Mexico, Italy, and Canada. Now, I just want to get your top two out of each pool, so I'll go first for Pool A, and we'll just go real quick and see who we think is going to come out, because I think the first round is pretty predictable, although I said we're going to have to pick an upset. I think it's going to come somewhere. So, there was a special, by the way, on the Brazilian team, which is being managed by Barry Larkin, that was on NHK that played on Sunday night. So I got to see some of it. And the Brazilian players, who a lot of them mostly speak Japanese and are playing with the Swallows, you just have to root for them, man. It's just, you know, they showed some highlights from their victory over Panama that got them into the tournament. Yeah, 1-0, man. It was awesome.
Scott Fernandez of the Swallows pitched the one that was the winning pitcher. Yeah, that was great. Great stuff he had that night.
Okay. Now, China has also improved since the highlights that we saw just before the Super Bowl of the 2006 games. And but I'll have to say that I'm going to go with Japan and Cuba because they're seasoned.
It's too hard. It's too hard to overcome people who play so much baseball like they do in Japan and Cuba. So I have to agree. Looking forward to seeing Brazil. China has the wild card. They have Bruce Chen, who had pitched for Panama, but Panama was knocked out by Brazil, so he made it to Japan by pitching for China. So that could be interesting. You know, that's a wild card in there if he has a heck of a game. Well, here's the thing about especially the first round. A pitcher can have a heck of a game, and he's gone after four innings.
Yeah.
And the Chinese actually have had pitchers who can throw, and they've got pitchers who can locate. The problem is the offense, and then if, you know, they get a close game against somebody weak, and Ray Chang hits a home run, then
yeah, I'm thinking that Brazil and China game is going to be must-see TV.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
Both of them think that they can win those games. So I think that, but other than that, I don't really see them getting the game.
Here's the thing. The winner doesn't have to qualify for the next. Basically, the teams that don't win a game will automatically be relegated if it's done like it was the last time. So if it's two and out, you'll probably have to qualify again. So, of course, the Chinese might want to qualify because they'll give them more games to play. They don't get enough games to play, so.
Yeah. Okay. In the next pool, Pool B, I'm thinking Korea and the Netherlands over Australia and Taiwan.
I like Taiwan because they're at home and they've got a couple of pretty good players, but the Netherlands, especially, we haven't heard of whether Jim Profarm,
yeah,
play for him or not. Yar Jurens, I think, is not going to pitch for him. That's
the Netherlands, right?
But Andrew Jones is ready to go, and Vladimir Ballantyne's ready to go. And there's a few players. They've got some pretty good players for the Netherlands. So
Xander Bogaerts, I heard, was pretty good. Yeah, I think the Netherlands should be able to come out here. And I think Korea is the favorite, but again, Taiwan could surprise some people and play a tough game.
Australia, I got my buddy John Deves is managing Australia again. He's like, you look at Australia, there's Deeble. And, of course, wish him luck. We'll see him in Osaka, but that's going to be tough to beat Korea and the Netherlands, I think.
Pool C, who do you got?
Well, Puerto Rico's at home. The Dominican's got a heck of a team. Venezuela is just being rocked by one injury and defection after another. And I haven't heard about Pablo Sandoval, but I don't know if he's healthy either. I haven't heard anything. So I'm going to go with Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic.
I was going to go with Venezuela to pull an upset here, and I didn't really think it was that much of an upset. But the people who have dropped out, Felix Hernandez of the Mariners is gone. I think Pablo is going to play because he's been playing in that Caribbean series. He has been playing down there, and a lot of those guys, I think, look ready. That's really going to be interesting the way they seem to be staying in shape this time. But again, with you, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, I can't see them losing. Even if Venezuela's at full strength, I don't see their pitching as the kind of pitching that's going to get them through. But if there's going to be an upset, I think that Venezuela can pull it off better than any other team. I think that's the biggest opportunity, but I don't know which team they're going to knock out.
Well, Spain's a goner.
I mean, if it's going to be the Dominican or if it's going to be Puerto Rico, I don't know which one of those teams they can knock out. But, yeah, Spain is a goner. What about in Pool D?
Pool D is a tough one. Italy's a goner. As much as I'd love to see Alessandro Maestri really bowl somebody over. Same thing with Dominican Republic. We've got a Swallow pitching Orlando Roman, who was just a dynamite for the Swallows last year. He'll be pitching for Puerto Rico. I don't think Dickie Gonzalez is going to pitch for him this time, but he has passed. Okay, Pool D, so many guys I like. I think Scott Matheson is, I don't know, he looks hurt. Mexico, there's some people I like in Mexico. I'm going to have to say Canada and USA.
Oh, you stole my thunder.
Sorry, dude.
That's all right. That's why I'm picking Canada, and not just because I talked to Aaron Guyon because he's Canadian. This is a shout out to our buddy Rob Small. Yeah, it's not just because we're picking Canada because we talked to a Canadian this time, but I wanted to pick my upset and I wanted to make it Canada because I actually don't know. This pick would be with my heart to pick the United States. They really, you know, as Robert Whiting said, they don't take it seriously. They talked about how serious it's going to be and blah, blah, blah. And you heard it in Aaron's discussion tonight. He says the media in the U.S. is just all over the U.S. players because what all of the roster is major league, made up of major leaguers, but that doesn't really mean anything. So,
and the other thing is it doesn't mean anything in March.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, well, I might change my pick here and go Mexico and Canada. I would love to see the USA get out. I think it would be better for the WBC as a whole because I think a lot of Americans, they're just interested in when pitchers and catchers report and they don't think about the WBC and for them, because usually the US is out of it by then anyway, so.
Well, let me tell you, I was shocked about something I told some friends. If Japan advances to the semifinals, I will be covering them in the U.S. And I called friends of mine in the Bay Area, and they're giant season ticket holders. And I said, "Are you going to? You know, what? When are you? They always go to camp. They always go to spring training." And I said, "Well, when are you going to? I might be there on the 16th or the 15th or the 16th. Let's get together." He says, "No, we're going to spring training on the 16th." And they're season ticket holders, and they did not know the WBC was being played at AT&T Park.
Therein lies the problem. It's because the U.S. is never there. So the U.S. has to get there. I really want them to do it, but I'm predicting that they're not going to do it this year either. Hopefully I'm wrong. I'm rooting for them, but hopefully I'm wrong, but we'll see. So I'm thinking Canada and Mexico. All right, we'll reserve our predictions for the second round for the next show. Let's move on to camp here in Japan. I was about to say the United States.
Cyberspace.
I've been watching as many news broadcasts as I can at night, and the thing that really, really has stuck out for me during these 2 weeks that we've been off from the show is the two-way practices that Shohei Ohtani is going through. Now, I've seen a couple experts on TV and talked to one guy, and they say, you know what, he's really got to concentrate on one thing or the other. He's not going to be a good pitcher, and he's not going to be a good position player if he's trying to do both in his first pro camp. Blah, 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 blah. But the thing that really made me laugh was he was taking ground balls literally with his right arm tied behind his back because they want him to protect it. They don't want him any ground balls to jump up and catch him on the arm. So he's got this arm tucked behind his back and he's fielding, and then he uses obviously his right arm to throw across the diamond. He's fielding at short and at third base, and you know, it's ridiculous because then he comes up and he's in batting practice and he bats left-handed and his arm's exposed to the ball. And especially with live pitching, you know, that's more dangerous, I think. So I don't know. What's your opinion on him going two ways there?
I love it. I think it's great. I think this is something because most of these guys who they're talking, they use the expression a double-edged sword. You know, these two-way players, most of them never get this far. They give them one bullpen session because either they can't throw or they can't hit.
Right.
They've washed out by now. This guy's been doing it for 10 days. Well, actually not true because he missed 3 days because he had to go take a test too so he could graduate from high school.
And they had a day off.
Right. So he's been doing it for 7 days essentially. And, most of them don't get that far. He can really throw, he can really hit. So, I would love to see a starting pitcher who could play, you know, right field twice a week. Or, you know, whatever. But, you know, what's the harm in that? The answer, and, you know, and what I say to the people who say, well, the people are saying he can't do it because most people can't do it. This is beyond the scope of most players. Now, they may be right. But on the other hand, I recall all the tennis professionals 10 years ago saying that Venus and Serena Williams would never become big stars unless they played more tournaments when they were teenagers. And as we know, that certainly, they were, who are those girls?
Yeah, how you like them now? Well, you know, when I was 18, and it was, oh, so many decades ago, I remember a lot of stuff, but I don't remember being worn out. I had energy for days, and this guy can play, and I saw him hit a couple home runs in batting practice where he barely flipped his, I mean, he just got the bat head out and the ball went over the fence. So I'm thinking he's got enough energy and he's not going to get worn out. What were you saying?
I was going to say, you used to have energy for days. What's your Energizer bunny level at now?
Hours.
Okay.
It's down to hours. All right. So, also there are five guys, working to get that, essentially that second base job that Kensuke Tanaka has vacated, and I will keep my eye on that. I would like to see Sugiya get the job.
I like Sugiya.
I like him a lot, but we'll have to see how that goes.
And I like Sugiya, and I also like Nishikawa. Nishikawa doesn't impress me with the glove. Sugiya impresses me with a lot of things. He was a real good minor league player and can field pretty well. Nishikawa, I don't think he's got the glove, but you know, I still, when I watch him hit, I can't help but see Michihiro Ogasawara because he's got the same kind of swing. And he looks like Ogasawara did when he was his age.
Yeah,
he's younger than when Ogasawara turned pro, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the other guys, Kato, Nakashima, Imanami, we'll have to see how they do. Now, the Buffaloes, and that's Lowe's with a L-O-W-S, recently added Yoshio Itoi. But I don't, you know, the thing, I saw him on TV the other day and he says, the first thing he says is, wow, this uniform looks strange on me.
Well, what do you expect?
And I'm like, well, you can't say that. You can't really see how it looks on you. That's for us to say.
That's, you know, he's got the out of body experience going on. He's gone, I don't look as good as I should.
I don't think he's, you know, he's at a crossroads here. I mean, obviously with the Buffaloes, an organization that has a lot of question marks, he's at a crossroads where he has to decide, you know, is he going to really put the effort in to impress to get to the major leagues if he really wants to go? Because I think this is the major league teams are going to think of this as a test for him.
His age, he ain't going to get any more tests. It's pass or fail.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's got to come out and show the commitment. I just don't see it in his eyes right now. He just looks lost. But maybe once the game starts, once the lights come on and the game starts, it'll be different for him.
Could be. Yeah, Buffaloes are an interesting concoction this year. They've got a lot of positives. Got a heck of an outfield. You know, they might think about playing four outfielders. They're so good.
They might have to.
Yeah, but the pitching staff, you were thinking about Kaneko and Mahara, but there's more. Everybody on that staff was injured last year. And I talked to one of the pitching coaches, Motoyuki Akahori, at the tail end of last season, and he said basically, we're not certain who we want to start because we got about 17 candidates. And, but Maestri has been good as a starter, and I suspect he's going to be around. And, well, I don't have much hopes for the lefty, Yagi. So.
I don't know. We'll see.
Kaneko has said basically, gee, my arm still hurts.
Yeah, I saw him, talking about, well, you know, my goal this year is to stay healthy. And I'm like, you hate to hear that.
Not to start the season.
That's like the vote of confidence for yourself.
I was pitching batting practice the other day in which, well, okay, here's the thing with Mahara, though. He did this all the time when he was the Hawks. I feel good, and suddenly he's off the roster.
Yeah.
So hard to know what's going on there, but they do not have a good history with keeping players. The Buffaloes have not had a history of keeping pitchers healthy. This is something that is beyond, they're like the Carp were 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. Every good they had, you know, is just like, here's a young guy, throw him in front of the bus.
Oh, wow. All right, well, good luck to them. Let's go to fielding questions. All right, so before I read the first question, I said in the show last time in the interview with Boomer Wells that Victor Starfin was born in Japan, and he was actually not born in Japan. He was born in Russia and raised here in Japan, so I wanted to make sure I got that straight. Now, the first question is from Anthony in Australia, and he says, hey, John, when speaking about non-Japanese in the Hall of Fame, how come you always leave out Isao Harimoto, who, from what I know, is massively proud of being Korean? Because if you use Sadaharu Oh as a non-Japanese, then Harimoto most certainly would be as well, wouldn't he? Yeah, I guess so. And then he says he's also wondering about Shosei Go, if he would be considered non-Japanese because he was born in Taiwan. But at the time, Taiwan was a colony of Japan, and he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, from what I know. And that's from Anthony in Australia. So.
Yeah, Shosei Go was a tremendous player, tremendous speed guy back in the game. Before 1949, Japanese baseball was the deadest of the dead. In fact, it was like baseball of the living dead. The strike zone was large. Everything was trying to put the ball in play. Everybody was trying to make contact. Pitchers weren't trying to strike you out. It was everything about putting the ball in play and throwing the ball out of the zone. You know, it was all about speed. And this guy was a big star. Well, I have to think he was probably, I don't know what the, I wish I had a better answer than just saying what a great player Shosei Go was, but, I don't know the details. It's always a little confusing. There's a great story about, Japan's, marathon gold medalist, and I believe from the 1936 Olympics, and he's an ethnic Korean. Born when Korea was a Japan colony, and Korea's tried to get him to be that medal be shifted to Korea, but the International Olympic Committee says no. He ran for Japan. He was Japanese. Forget it.
Right. I just remember when I looked up his name in Wikipedia, it had a Taiwanese flag on it. Mm-hmm. So if that's, and remember when we talked to the Hall of Fame people, they said, look, they don't require anyone to write down their nationality when they add them to the Hall of Fame, so they don't know how many and who are non-Japanese and who are Japanese. So I wish we could give you a better answer, but at least we did answer the question. Now, he has another question. What can MLB/the United States learn from Japan? And I think in terms of baseball, and I said it earlier in this show, and I think, yeah, Japan bunts probably too much, but I think in the United States, there could be more bunting. And I hear a lot of people say, hey, look, you're giving away an out. You're giving away an out. But in late game situations, when you have a good bullpen, I don't think giving away the out for the possibility of giving or putting yourself in a better position to score a run, I don't think it's such a bad trade-off. And I think I often hear these experts talking about how what a waste it is to give up a run, let the guys hit the ball. And I often think that too, but there's some in some cases, in some matchups, you're definitely better off pushing the runner and getting him over in that base, putting more pressure on the defense than you are in letting a struggling hitter or somebody who's not having going well face a tough pitcher.
Yeah. Okay. What I would say is that being able to bunt is analogous to a number of other skills in baseball. You know, like being able to turn the double play or being able to run or be able to steal bases or steal signs for that matter or get hit with a ball. You know, there are times when that will win you the game, and to have that extra dimension will win you games. Not a lot of games, but if you take a team, which is two teams, all everything else being equal, and one can bunt, is pretty good at bunting, and one is not very good at bunting, the team that is pretty good at bunting will win a game or two more. Probably one more, but that might be the game that gets you into the postseason. So, I would rather have team speed than a team full of bunters, but I'd rather have power than lots of team speed, although you can't play defense unless you're fast. So, but anyway, it's just another skill. Now the other thing in Japan they have is the philosophy, which is a killer. But again, teams play that way. Teams in Japan are intimidated by the bunt, which is really interesting. So when you're in Japan, bunting has, you're sort of going into the twilight zone where things have different weights and values to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
The Cebu Lions, I did a study, 20 years ago now, where I looked at what happens when the Cebu Lions leadoff batter got on in the first inning. And what I found out was, when the number two batter bunted, the number three and four batters, now what you would expect is that they would essentially score fewer runs, and they actually do score slightly fewer runs than when the guy doesn't bunt. But they score so many runs in these innings. What happened was, teams overreacted to the Lions having one out and a runner on second. And the outfielders would cheat in because they didn't want to give up a run to the Lions who had this great pitching and defense.
Right.
Cheat in. And the three and four hitters stopped hitting home runs but started hitting scads of doubles and triples.
Mm.
Ended up with big innings because all of a sudden it's one out and they've got another runner on second base. And then now they're paranoid about that guy scoring. They got the cleanup batter coming up.
Right. So, yeah, like I said, it puts a lot of pressure on the defense. So he's got one more question.
Okay.
Why aren't there more retired numbers in MVP teams? And as far as retired numbers go, I have no idea. Wayne Grasek, whom we had on the show late last year, also made light of the same situation. And teams act like these numbers are sacred ground. At the very least, it's a way for teams to honor the players, especially those who don't get into the Hall of Fame. I don't know why there aren't many more retired numbers. They've given some of these minor league guys, they give them 117 or 120 or triple zeros and all these other things. They have the numbers available, I think.
Well, no, they don't. Now, here's the thing, and this leads into the next question from Brian in California. They don't have the numbers because there's a 70-man roster. So they've basically got 30 guys they can retire. the guys who are over 100 or the ones that are the zero, the odd numbers, other than 00. So they actually have 101 numbers they can use from 00 to 99. Yeah, that's 101. The other guys are Ikusei, the developmental players, who are on different contracts and cannot appear in first team games. Mm-hmm. So there is a limit on how many they could retire. In the major leagues, they have essentially 40 guys they've got to reserve numbers for because they have a 40-man roster, and even then they don't even need that many. So it is odd, though, and it's odd because in Japan, when a player is still in his uniform, they do everything to sell that player's carcass that they can think of. You know, they try to sell these guys as coaches. I mean, that's why people want Araki, Daisuke Araki, to be manager of the Swallows, because he was once a kind of a teen idol who signed with the Swallows because he was drafted by the Swallows. So let's make it, wouldn't it be keen if he was our manager? Think how popular we'd be. Think of all the people who'd come to the ballpark to see Araki manage us. So, and one of the reasons Ochiai was unpopular with a team owner was that he didn't care whether a coach played for the Dragons or not. He didn't use the Dragons coaching staff as a jobs program for former Chunichi players.
Mm-hmm.
That riled a lot of people in baseball because that's what coaching staffs are for. So, why don't they market these guys who are retired? You know, why don't they use the, you know, have big games and all this? And that's a mystery to me. The Giants do. The Giants have the retired numbers up, you know, up there at Tokyo Dome. But nobody else does.
Yeah, yeah. All right. The next question is from Brian in California, as you mentioned. And he says, I enjoy your podcast. I've learned a lot about Japanese baseball by listening. Thank you very much, Brian. His question is, do the Japanese roster rules work the same way as they do here in the United States? I've heard you say there's a 73-man roster. Does that mean that every farm player is on the team roster?
Rules are very different. There's a 70-man roster. So if, for example, you have a guy on a developmental contract and you want to bring him up and you don't have, you know, and you're already 70 guys, you got to drop somebody. The developmental guys are different. They get paid, they can get paid less, but, the minimum salary, I'm guessing if I can remember here, the minimum salary in NPB is 4.8 million yen. But if you're playing on the first team and your contract is less than, 10 million yen, you get paid an extra per diem for every day you're on the first team. So pretty much if you're on the first team roster, you're getting 10 million yen a year minimum. Okay, now, the 70 guys can be brought, with some restrictions, they can be brought back and forth as many times as the team wants them to be. There's a 10-day, when you send somebody down, they have to stay down for 10 days. But they can come back on the 10th day. What else? There is no minor league free agency in Japan. If a guy's in America, guys don't come up and down because there's a penalty. You can lose them. There's a limited number of times you can bring a guy up and down from the minor leagues. In Japan, because there's no limit, then there's no minor league free agency. There's no idea that the guy, anybody who's been in Japan, Japanese baseball, for years, has been on the first team as, you know, the water boy or something. So those guys who've never been on first team roster, if they've been there 6 years and haven't played, they don't have a job anymore. They've been fired.
Right. So yeah, it's very different from in the United States. Now he also asks, if you sign a gaijin or foreign free agent, do you have to clear a roster spot for him?
Oh no. Yeah. Yeah. Same unless they're on the developmental roster. This is a new trend in Japan that foreign players, they're using the developmental rosters as real minor league. They're taking players who they don't think they can use and they don't want to spend much money on, trying them out in minor league games, signing them to developmental contracts for, $10,000-$20,000 a year, $30,000. I think the minimum is $25,000 or something, which is still better than what you get playing in 3A. But, yeah, they have these cheap contracts, and they can see what they like. These players are easy to sign, easy to get rid of, and if you want to use one, you have to add them. You have to give them a standard NPB contract. So, and it is a lot of, you know, now we've got a lot of stars who in Japan who started as developmental players. And I give you two of them. Two of them were rookies of the year with the Yomiuri Giants, Tetsuya Yamaguchi and Tetsuya Matsumoto. And,
Kakunaka from last year.
I don't know. He was not a developmental player. He came out of the independent league. But Okada was a developmental player, their new captain.
Okay, maybe I mixed them up. All right, his final question was, how many players are on the, he calls it a major league roster, we call it first team roster here. How many players are on the first team roster during the regular season?
Again, difficult, because there's two answers. One answer is 28, one answer is 25. Japan has a peculiar setup where they can have 28 guys on the roster, but 25 on the bench. And what they use is, what they do with this is they keep, fewer starting pitchers. Or they keep, they take three starting pitchers and tell them to go sit in the clubhouse during the game. So they can have extra bench players. They actually have a 28-man roster. This is one reason why you never see, an infielder come in and win a game as on the pitcher's mound like Wilson Valdez did last year for the Phillies.
Not last year, but a couple 3 years ago, yeah.
Because you don't need emergency pitchers, because when you've got a 28-man roster, you can have 14 pitchers on the roster.
So yeah, you can dress 25.
Yep.
But they're 28 on the roster. All right. Brian, thank you very much for the question. Anthony, thank you as always. Anyone else who wants to send a question? And people, I implore you to send your MP3 questions so you can hear your own voice on the show. It's so cool. Send them to the yakyujohn@gmail.com or send us a note or leave us a note on the Facebook page and we'll address them on the show. We have two more weeks until another show, and then the WBC is going to kick off, so we're going to be concentrating on that as we get closer and closer to seeing this thing finally go off for the third time. I think this is going to be the best one ever.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right, man. Good job tonight.
Talk to you next time, everyone.
All right. Good night. Enjoy your 2 weeks until the next show.